May use it as pointing device.
Oh.
Maybe yes, maybe no.
I think we left.
No.
Very small mistake.
So, welcome everybody. This talk is about deploying Debian and Debian-like systems in large infrastructure, in particular in the. You're so not blinded. We have in particular in a large university setting. So, folks who are interested in how to do this get some ideas and ask some questions, hopefully. And we're lucky to have Frank Brocken with us here. Andy. You want to come up and give the intro? I just wanted to.
I think you should keep going.
We are saving some time.
So we have Frank Brocken here, and I'm afraid that I actually can't even pronounce
Groningen.
Groningen.
Now you're close.
Okay.
Yeah. Andy did a good job, actually.
So I'm just going to turn it over so we can get started, and hopefully we'll have a chance for questions and stuff at the end.
That's awesome. Yeah. Thank you very much, and thank you for attending my talk. This is the opening slide that I'm sure you have seen by now. So I'll immediately switch to a completely, I hope, surprising slide. Now that's this. This is Debian, as you can see from the headline. And this started about, say, 15 years ago, where my wife and I, Esther, were entering the high sierras in the western part of the United States, which is Windows. And we were constantly frustrated by roads that we couldn't enter and things that were blocked for us. And so we decided to completely head the other way. And eventually, we found our way into the Californian and Nevada deserts. This is probably the northern tip of Death Valley National Park. And it's a beautiful area. It's very hot in the summer. And it's extremely cold in the winter, and short, it's a beautiful piece of nature. And I don't care if all these people stay in high sierras and use their Windows system, as long as we can use our Debian system, we are happy and we are in the wild and we can do all these nice things that Debian has to offer us. So what am I going to tell you in particular? Here are the topics that I had in mind. A little bit about the context. I'm going to tell you a little bit about that strange name, University of Groningen in the Netherlands. And don't try to pronounce it unless you are a fluent Dutch or Hebrew speaker. And in there, there was at some point in the university a call for an alternative working place. That is an alternative computer working place where people could do their computer things. And that became eventually the Linux working place, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about that. But there's much more Debian at the University of Groningen than the Linux working place. I and my group have been using Linux from the very, very early 90s, so that was even before version 1.0 came out, and we switched to Debian, I think, in its first year of existence. I'm going to talk about that. In detail. There's more Debian at the university, more or less because of that switch that we made, and I'm going to give you an overview of the kind of Debian products that you may encounter there as well. Somewhat extensive example will be Stealth, which is a file integrity scanner that was designed about 5 or 6 years ago. Then I have some conclusions and maybe questions. So first of all, as we learned from Andy's talk, open is in. There's a smorgasbord of open things. If you look at the web, there are all kinds of open things. And one of the things that I haven't heard about since Andy's talk was open government, but I'll add that to my smorgasbord as well. Interesting is that in Europe, all these various governments, and over here, this is my pointing device, over here, you see the Dutch Parliament buildings. there is a law was passed that requires official organizations to start using open source products. And now that's a bill. And before it is actually effectuated, you are probably tens of years farther, but at least that bill was passed. Andy talked about Munich. The country of Denmark this year decided that their official product must be, their official documents must be written in the open document format. So that is a great step. And once you see that at all these levels, people and then governments are accepting open sources as their favorite standards, then you see that the supernatural thing, the European Union, and here we have the Parliament building for the European Union in Brussels, that the European Union as a supranational organization also enforces that bill and requires that the member countries start promoting open source. So we are at a perfect moment in time to promote open source products in all lower levels, because we can say governments require that. If you would like to have an overview at worldwide use of open source products, then I would like to refer you to the Center of Strategic and International Studies, which is located in Washington. And my paper that will be in the proceedings of this conference gives you the reference, but I'm sure you can find that on the web. It gives an extensive list of all kinds of open source products as they are required or used in the world. You may have used that list, actually. I don't know if you did. Are you aware of that?
No.
No, but it's a nice list. I looked at that list, it's great. So, the context, a little bit national and supranational stuff. Then if we look at the university, the University of Groningen is the but one oldest university in the Netherlands. It was founded 1614, only some 49 years after its first university was founded, Leiden, in 1575. The University of Groningen has about 25,000 students, and our staff consists of about 5,000 people. That's not only scientific staff, that's also support staff and things like that, but there are also, there are all in like 30,000 people working at the University of Groningen. Well, students, well, yeah, they work. Since several years, the university's information of technology center is responsible for running all its IT facilities. And what we see here is the main building. It has a remarkable architecture. The main building of the Center of Information Technology, what I like about this picture is the fact that it shows this window up here behind which is my office. So I got this from the web, and I think it's a great, great picture. It gives you an idea in what kind of location we are. As you know, the Netherlands is full of water, and so we are in a little pond because they thought there wasn't enough water in the Netherlands. The University of Groningen is well known for its high performance computing work, and one of the main projects that we run is the LOFAR project, which is a project on astronomy, which is the equivalent of the largest radio telescope in the world, which has a diameter of, I think, 200 miles. Now, you cannot build a structure like that. So what it did some really ingenious things with all kinds of measuring points spread out over an area with a diameter of 200 miles, and that effectively acts as a big dish in which you can collect all these astronomy data. All those data run into our computer center, is cleaned up there, is washed, is filtered, and that's one of the things that we do. We see here some pictures of these big halls, and in there, apart from the supercomputers that are used for the LOFAR by all kinds of servers for the email, for the university library, for basically everything that you would like to have at the university to keep it running. And most of these systems are running on Unix kind of operating system. There are some Windows systems in there, but I would rather not talk about those. At some point, if you look at this, this is the server area, if I may give it that name. But people at their desks and the students, they are using very simple computers. And for a long time, it has been MS Windows that has been the working place, which became a standard working place in the early 90s. And I think that's a very bad idea, but on the other hand, at that time you really couldn't give the university students and staff members a Unix-like system. Either it was commercially much too expensive, or it wasn't ready to be spread out over the whole university. Initially we used Slackware, but that required you to recompile every package from scratch at that time, and that was a non-option for the normal user. So Slackware was not an option. And so our traditional working place, and I like this horrible picture about the Windows business with all these drools drooping down and things like that. It's of course horrible. It is not open, you have no idea what's going on behind the scenes, except for that it's bad, it is expensive, it takes a fair amount of the budget for the IT facilities for the university, it's monopolistic, that's bad. I will be back to that. And it is constantly in need of repairs. Now I don't say that our open source products do not need repairs and don't have bugs, but this is symptomatic. It is symptomatically wrong, and you can more or less prove that it cannot be better than it is. Fortunately, at some point, there were open source alternatives for almost everything people were using at their normal desktops. So why don't you use open source products? Especially if the political climate at that moment is favorable towards open source. There are more problems with the traditional working place. One of the things is that if everybody is using Windows, well, that basically holds true for everything that you use as a monoculture. If more than 50% of your systems is that particular system, then you're running the risk of a monoculture and thereby of all kinds of diseases. Let's see, how many of you running Linux, Debian Linux, run a virus scanner on your computer? Okay, there are two, yeah? How many of you run also Windows system occasionally? Well, I do sometimes, unfortunately, with a virus scanner running. So that is exactly the reason why monoculture is so dangerous. It is the only system that is run by a large number of computers in your organization, and the attacker only needs to find one vulnerability in that system, and a whole range of your computers is gone. The malware tends to target the dominant, in this case, Windows system. And because that system is so complex, you cannot get it right. So there are plenty of reasons for using open source alternatives. I have a nice example in about 2007. At once, one particular day, over 200 computers of our university were infected by a group of hackers and became victimized to that hackers group. I don't think you could do that even if they were all running Debian, because there are so many variants of that Debian system. I mean, there is a basic operating system below there, but what everybody is using in their computers is basically varying from installation to installation. So it was time to start realizing the Linux workplace. And indeed, it was clear by the time we started working on that, that it should be a Linux working place, because the Linux working place, I mean, we had a stable system, we have all the software in place, and so why don't you use that system as an alternative? There are very good reasons for doing that. The choice now is what kind of system. Should we use Red Hat? Should we use Slackware? Should we use SUSE? In fact, there were two competitors, and that was Ubuntu and Debian. To me, there's not so much difference. I prefer Debian. I run Debian since, what did I say, early 90s or something like that, right? And it seems that Ubuntu is somewhat more familiar to the common user, but if you're more into the computer system itself, if you're more interested in what's going on behind the scenes, then Debian might be your system of choice. And if you go to the core system administrators of our university, and here we have one fine example of a system administrator at the University of Pioneer, and his words when I took this picture were, "You can't find anything on GUI Ubuntu." Now, I don't want to offend my wife, who is in the back of the room there, but this morning she had a problem connecting to the university's here wireless internet, and me too couldn't find something on GUI Windows. So I think he may be right when he focuses on that GUI character of Ubuntu. Fortunately, for the distribution of the system, it's not so much a problem. The Linux working place looks like this. If you have difficulty reading this diagram, I can completely understand that, and that's not the point. The point is not that you cannot read this diagram, because I'm going to dissect this diagram in a few minutes. So this is the whole picture. This is what Jurgen Bokma, and his picture is over here. Jurgen Bokma is one of my colleagues, and he runs the Linux Working Place project. Now, his name is a famous name in the Netherlands, Bokma, because Bokma is the manufacturer of a particular kind of booze in the Netherlands called Genever. And since there is no wine being grown in the Netherlands, I thought it might be a nice idea to bring to the cheese party a bottle of Bokma. Unfortunately, when I passed yesterday through customs, the security officer looked at my bag and said, "What's in there?" And he looked in there, and I found my bottle of Bokma, which I bought at a liquor store. And he said, "That's not sealed, so you cannot take that into your plane to the United States." So I had no other option than to remove the Bokma bottle, give it to the customs official and say, "I hope you like it." There'll be no Bokma at the cheese party, but I took some Dutch cheese, so I hope you like that. So let's go back to business. Back to business. There is this working place. And the unattended install goes from some plain computers using all kinds of mirrors to a computer that can be, in principle, booted. It's not yet ready to do that. And if your original computer was a Windows system, it comes out of the initial unattended install as a dual boot. Now, interesting here is that we use our own Ubuntu mirror, and we have an own package repository. And those repositories are, of course, Debian repositories. And for this, I had the help of the Debian developer, George Danchev, who helped us creating those packages. George is from Bulgaria, and we invited him over to the university for a workshop for about a week, where he trained us to create packages, how to create these repositories, so we could do all these kinds of things ourselves from then on. Now we are here. We have computers that will become the Linux workplace, either pure or dual boot. Then in the second part, we are going to create images. We use a Novell product for that, and it creates images. An image for each of these different forms, the dual boot form or the single Linux workplace. Then from that, we clone computers that will eventually be installed in the several departments and that run specific scripts. The university has a Class B network, and that's subdivided on all kinds of smaller networks, and these smaller networks have their own IP addresses, ranges of IP addresses, have their own system administrators, have all these little kinds of specific things that must be fine-tuned, must be tweaked for that particular situation. That happens in the first boot period, and from there you have a running either dual boot or running Linux workplace. And that is an eventual working place for either the student's working place or it is a working place for a staff member. Depends on where the person is working. And then if you look at what you have, then you have something that is not a standalone system as such. Well, this computer talks with all these kinds of supporting systems around it. That's why there are all these arrows running towards these installed computers. For example, the basic system administrative work software is installed in these computers. The user's home directories, they tend to be roaming, and that means that if you log in into this computer, you have your home directory. If you log into that home computer, you have your home directory as well. So all the home directories and users' own unpackaged software will be available there as well. Then authentication takes place using LDAP, actually. That's spelling error. That's the LDAP system. But what we do for authentication is we immediately copy the root credentials in its hashed form into the working place computer. So just in case this one goes down, you can still log in here. Then we have remote services and remote administration that we use all these kinds of products for, and the fact that it says here Novell iPrint doesn't mean that it has to be Novell, but that's what Jurgen made when he created this picture for me. Then there's a service desk that can talk with the users here and give them help if they are run into problems. There are all kinds of statistics being collected and being used. You can immediately see if a computer is being used, where it is located, who is using that computer. And if you are, for example, a student and you would like to find a working place, you call the help desk and say, I would like to have a Linux workplace, and where do I find the nearest? And then the help desk employee says, where are you located right now? Well, I'm here. Okay, if you go there into that room, there's that computer, and it's available for you. Very helpful. So that's the system. Now, how flexible it is. So we have a Linux working place and it's being created. How flexible? It is not complete. It cannot be complete. You have like 30,000 people, and all these people have their specific wishes and things like that. But we think that the Linux workplace will be asymptotically complete. In the sense that once somebody asks for a particular package, whether it exists or not, it will be added to our standard Linux working place. So tomorrow's standard is a superset of today's standard. And to quote Larry Wall, the good thing about standards is that there are so many of them. And indeed, we have tomorrow another standard than we have today. Every added package, every new package will be added to that system. That's very good. How do you do that? Well, there are basically three ways to do that. You can, as an ordinary user, say, I have this program and it's great, I would like to have that into the standard Linux working place. Now, there are two routes. The formal route is to file a request with the service desk, and then eventually it winds up in the Linux working place. But it is much faster and much smarter to go to Jurjen and say, hey Jurjen, you are running a project, could you help me out and do that program into the LVP? Yeah, fine, good, let's do it. And it will be there in an hour or so. If you are a more experienced user, you can have sudo root access. That means you get a right to run a script from your computer on that controls the organization of the software in the repositories and makes sure that that requested package becomes embedded in the Linux working place. And then there are these kind of super users that are so trusted that they can be given direct access to the root partitions of these mirrors and repositories. That's good. If you're in that, then you can fuck up and you can change all the things around. But you are trusted, and of course you don't do that. Very nice. So that's it. Is that all? No, that is not all. I already mentioned George Dunchev, and this picture of this little squirrel I found on his Facebook site. We've seen George earlier in an earlier slide, so we now have a problem. We don't know if he looks like the one in the earlier slide, or if this is the one he looks like. The other one here is Tony Mansell, and we can verify his picture because he's sitting over there in the room. There he is. And both George and Tony have been extremely helpful and willing to support me in creating the Debian packages that I have been creating over time. And I will give a short overview and somewhat more extensive overviews of those packages. To teach programming languages, one of the languages that we teach is the C++ language, and for that, since the early 90s already, we use a document that has been enlarged and grows over the years, which is called the C++ annotation, which is now a Debian package as well. At the end of that programming course, my students learn how to create their own grammars. And for that, I created a C++ parser generator, much like Bison, but now specifically aiming at the creation of C++ source files. I've been writing various tools, IncMake, which is a make utility, XD, which is actually a very nice little tool. It's an abbreviation for extra small directory change. And you can do something like XD-ULB, and then XD will change directory for you to, for example, user local bin. Very nice, very addictive, and I don't think I could survive if I cannot use XD anymore. And there's Yodel and Stealth. Now Yodel is what they do in the Alps, but it's also something else, and I have two somewhat extensive examples of these projects, Yodel and Stealth. Yodel is a meetup pre-document language. It can be used to write all kinds of documents in a very simple way, and I've given you an example of how to create a manual page using Yodel. One of the things that you see here, that all the meta characters that you use in a meta language, they're only parentheses. But it's a special meta character in the sense that if it is not used as a meta character, it's just a parenthesis. So that's nice. You don't have to do special escape things and that kind of thing. And if you do something like that, you just write what you would like to do in plain text. And then eventually you get something like, for example, HTML, or you get LaTeX, or you get plain text, or you get Giro file. This one, if you use it to create a manual page, you get a Giro file, and it comes out like that. It's a perfect manual page, and all the manual pages that you will see in the Debian products that I've been creating, they're all made using YOLO, and it's a jiffy. It's absolutely nothing to do with. We do it for big documents as well, but I'll spare you the illustration. You should read the manual page for that. Now, here. If you look at the Linux working place, try to extend that. Try to extend what's going on there to the whole university. Then you will agree with me that there are many, many systems that must be in a pristine state. The software in there must be okay. Hackers, the bad guys, will try to intrude at some point in those systems, and we try to chase them away, but at some point they will succeed. What are hackers doing when they are into your system? They change things. No matter what way you look at it, they will change things. So the idea that we at some point had was, why don't you have a program that verifies the integrity of your essential software? And that's what Stealth is doing. Normally, what you do, you have all these kinds of standard things, right? There's frequent uploads, you check your logs, you do a default deny, all these standard security things. No worse comes to worse. And the hacker really enters your computer. How do you track the hacker if your log files don't tell you that something has happened? If he comes through the default deny policy? If you have upgraded to your latest software, what do? You run Stealth. The SSH-based trust enforcement acquired through a locally trusted host. Now I want you to look closely at that expansion of the word Stealth, and you will probably understand that it took me quite some time to find this meaning for the word Stealth. And yes, it is. It is an open source file integrity checker, and the core idea, fortunately, is not mine, so I can proclaim it here in all absence of any modesty. What you do is you create a fingerprint of the current state. Now, many integrity checkers do that, mind you, so that's nothing new, but that's what you do. You detect modifications of the fingerprint. Many integrity checkers do that. And then you separate, and this is new, the state info from the target computers that are being checked. So your fingerprints and the handling of the comparisons are not taking place on the computers that are being checked for their integrity. So this is the setup. We have a Stealth monitor, we have SSH connections, we have several client computers that may be connected to the internet, and that's it. Several. I wrote two here, but there may also be 200 or 2,000. Very good. We only need one Stealth monitor. And also, we would like to have this system as separated as possible from the internet. There shouldn't be any incoming connection into that computer, only outgoing connections. So that's it. So what do we do then? The fingerprints that we get from the software here is maintained on this computer. And there are no specific things on these computers that hint to the fact that Stealth is being used to check the integrity of the software of these client machines. Now, a client machine could be a server computer, and it could be a user computer, it could be a Linux working place computer. It could be a repository. The Stealth monitor computer itself is inaccessible. If you want to access that computer, you have to go to its console and log in as a user, and then you have access. But there's no way to access that computer from a distant location. Interesting thing is, that, again, different from existing file integrity checkers, that nothing is pre-specified by stealth that adds to its stealthy characteristics. If you would like to use this kind of software to verify the integrity or inspect or generate the statistics, you do that. If you would like to use that software, that's fine. You could use find, you could use MD5-SUM or SHA-256-SUM, all these kinds of software that are available. You could use those software to verify what the actual state is on your client computers. Now, in order to do that, it is clear that if you are using on the client computers programs like Find or these HashSum computer software, that that software must of course be in a pristine stage as well. So that we can do as well. We can check locally whether the state of that software that's used there is still intact. So we can inspect vital software locally. And finally, normally you would do a stealth run or something that you would like to do every once in a while using a cron job, but even that could be a hook that is used by the attacker to see whether something is going on. If always at a certain moment in time, find is running or the hash is computed of files, then the hacker might start to think, isn't there something weird going on? So we can change this in such a way that the stealth runs themselves are not predictable. They may start at any moment in time. You can say to stealth, do for example, in the first 20 minutes of every hour, do a check. Or do a check once every hour. It's up to you to decide when to do that. You have complete freedom to specify when you would, in what interval you would like to do these integrity checks. And it's easy to configure that. So let me give an example. Here is what you do to check the integrity of the system's set UID files. You have some arguments that you would like to specify with the find command, where you say, I'm interested in the SUIDU and group flags for the user root or the group root, and those arguments are being added to the find command, where this one is replaced by what I wrote here, and for that you run the SHA-1-SUM program. That one is being run for all the SUID files on your target computer, and the logs are being sent using a secure connection to the stealth monitor. And what you can get is these kinds of reports. For example, the hacker added a file. He added a file /usr/bin/rootperm. I didn't do that. There is no package called /usr/bin/rootperm, and suddenly it appears. Who has done that? Let's investigate. This is its hash. It wasn't there to begin with, and not only that, the bastard also removed sbin Unix check password. He removed that one. Why did he do that? I don't care, but he did it, and we have to take measures to prevent him using it. And of course, this is a nice one. He modified the login program into a cooked version of his own. All this information you get automatically, and it's very hard for a hacker to detect it. We've been using stealth now for several years on all our important systems, and it runs as a chart. Perfect. So that's it. SSH-based trust enforcement. And then somebody hacked through the screen, acquired through a locally trusted. This is a locally trusted host, of course, because you have to trust this computer to do all these funny things on your client computers. Connections are SSH-based and it is trust enforcement. So that's the system, and that's how it got its name. That's a Debian product. It's been there for, well, I don't know how long.
Long.
It's one of the first things I think that we added to the list of projects.
Yeah.
So, conclusions. There's a worldwide interest right now, and I can say worldwide because we know that because of that Washington organization. There's a worldwide interest in open source products. You can use that to convince your managers or decision makers that they really should, I don't say switch to, but at least consider changing to open source projects. And if you use monocultural operating systems, as we've seen, for example, from that hack that we had, thank you, monocultural operating systems are inherently dangerous. It's not only the case in software, it is also the case in agriculture, and in intensive farming and all kinds of things. Last year, we had in the Netherlands, we had a case of the Q fever with goats, and that resulted in the killing of, I think, 20 or 30,000 goats, where more than half of them had no fever at all. And that's called preventive cleaning up. I think that's preventive killing, and I have some other strong feelings about that that I'm not going to share here because I might offend people, but in private I could say the University of Groningen by now has an alternative, not to killing goats, but to using a working page. That's the Linux working page. And the nice thing about that is that it is an alternative. We are not enforcing people into using Linux. No, we are offering them a choice. We are offering them a choice. You can be continuing using that bastard system that you've been using over years, but you will have much more fun if you at least considered switching to something else. Like what we did like 15 years ago when we decided not to go into the high Sierras, but into the desert. Debian packages. It is of such good quality, people. You have an idea how good it is because you're all Debian folks. Jurgen told me that he has been working for 5 years intensively creating that limit workbook thing, upgrade on upgrade. And over those 5 years, he didn't have a single problem with dependencies, with software that didn't work, with things that broke when you upgraded to a new version of Debian. It works perfectly. There's no other system that does it so well. And actually, that was the main reason why the university decided to start using Debian as its main system, rather than, for example, a system like Red Hat. So, we covered the things that I intended to do. Why should we use open source? I told you a bit about the reasons why we wanted to switch to a Linux working place. I told you a bit how that is organized. You now know what kind of products we are running. I gave you some examples and some conclusions, and there's only one thing left for me to do, and that is to thank you for your attention. That's it. There are room for some questions.
Do we have a microphone in case someone? Thank you.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for the talk and description. I'm curious about, you sort of described the deployment scenarios. I'm curious if you could describe a little bit about the maintenance approaches. For instance, if you're using configuration management tools, for once the machines have been deployed, how do you keep them up to date? Is it just a rewrite process and reinstall, or?
I think you do that the way, I'm not sure, because you're actually over asking me. But I think from what I understand from what Jürgen told me is that they do what you always do. You do an app update and an app upgrade every once in a while and make sure that you have the recent software. And if upstream in our own repositories change something, then that software is being redeployed. And from we have the, let me see if I can go back to those slides. No, there's the unattended install, and then you have the next slide. Remember where the installation takes place. There's also something where you can, at the third slide, I think that was visible, where you do remote system administration and system maintenance. That is the situation where the administrator is able to draw from the repositories and spread the new software over the distributed Linux working places. Is that an answer to your question?
Yep, I think so.
Okay.
You should. There will be a puppet birds of a feather session coming up later in the conference that I think you might be interested in. Just be worth talking about. Puppet is a configuration management system.
Yeah.
For
and I know that we are using several non-Debian tools right now. Jürgen also told me that he had some problems finding the right tools in the Debian standard software, but things change, and maybe right now there are appropriate tools. For example, one of the things that is going to be changed is that we are using SIFS right now to mount the user home directories, and that will be changed shortly into NFS version 4. So things like that change.
We've tried to do SIFS for user home directories at the University of Connecticut.
Yeah.
We tried to do SIFS for user home directories at the University of Connecticut. We had trouble with the window managers. They create some sort of log files or some special files that SIFS didn't support.
Yeah.
Did you have that problem? And if so, how did you work around it?
I don't think so, because we're talking about Linux. We're talking about Linux.
Right, Linux creates, like GNOME and KDE, create some special files in the home directories.
Okay.
And SIFS doesn't support that.
Okay. So it may be that Jürgen told me that he had several problems with, indeed, SIFS. He didn't explicitly go into what kind of problems that was. There was simply no time to do everything there. And he said, but I don't care. I'm not going to solve that right now. We are trying to get a way around it. Maybe I can give you your address and you could contact him anyway. And he said, I don't care because we are going to switch to NFS level 4 shortly anyway, so why invest money into a dead bird or something else? Yeah? Does that more or less answer your question?
Yep.
If you would like to have your address, come to me and I'll give you after.
Thank you.
Session. Okay.
I think the
button's
actually not working.
It's also not feeding in.
Oh, okay. So this is sort of pointless. But yeah, that is no problem. You run into that with OpenFS as well. I recommend looking at AFS before you decide for sure to do NFS before. There are features both ways, but AFS is also open source project, also in Debian. Worth taking a look at. It's a little idiosyncratic in some respects, but it gives you management capabilities that NFS doesn't have. But yeah, it's a known problem with file systems that don't really like special devices. I'm pretty sure there's a way to change it in the known configuration to use a different directory to store that stuff, and then you just stick that somewhere on local disk to store just those session sockets and leave the rest of the stuff out of the user home directory.
Okay, thank you. I think there was another question over there.
I'm just wondering, in the university setting, I haven't seen anyone training Debian developers. Do you have any plans for...
Well, we had George coming over to train us using the package constructions and things like that. And most of our core system administrators prefer Debian anyway, so they are pretty well versed in using Debian. And then, well, you know how it goes. There's a new guy coming in and he's learning from the existing people. then he can do it as well. And he can read also. Most Dutch people can read. And so they read the manual, and they can do things that the other guys could do also. I'm kidding you slightly, but you know what I mean. It's not that much of a problem. Does that answer your question? You're welcome to visit us. I mean, come to us and talk to Jurgen in person and see what he did. Or also, I can give you his address and you can contact him. And I'm sure he's happy to write back to you. Okay?
Class. Aren't we reached the moment where we should break up and people who want to go to another talk can go? And we can wait for people to come up in hours.
Okay. Let's have another.